It's seafood season, and your favorite seafood sensation is back at White Castle. Say hello to Shrimp Nibblers. With delicious butterfly shrimp battered in a crispy coating, it's never been easier to follow your crave. So head to White Castle and dive into delicious Shrimp Nibblers today for a limited time, only at White Castle. Follow your crave while supplies last.
There was no debate on it. If one knew my journey, that speech was going to be in Irish.
If I don't trust you, Fiji can cork it. Others are corking, you can cork it.
The only Irish I had coming to Cork was Slánta, because there was a souvenir hanging up in a kitchen wall in Sydney. I started to go to school in Amman, and I'm in fifth class, and I'm starting to grasp this new language, which is like Hindu or Mandarin to me. I'm so far behind my peers. I want to question to my dad, do I really need to learn Irish? But you just trust your parents that they're doing the right thing for you. I go through a few painful years, embarrassing years of trying to learn Irish. I'm 48 years of age now. Very thankful that I went through that painful experience. You don't make that journey alone. Along the way, you need help from all different types of people. And I get that in buckets and spades.
Irish is obviously very important, and people would have probably heard before, you know, the idea of dressing you up on the green on St. Patrick's Day and making sure you listened to the All-Ireland finals on the radio when they were being relayed in Australia. So I suppose that sense of Irishness was probably inbuilt in you as kids very early as well, was it?
The Irish story of me is really my dad's story, because basically my dad is from County Fermanagh, so Irish wouldn't have been taught when he was growing up in primary school. He leaves the country at a very young age, say in his late teens, to go working. So this is Ireland, 1970s, you know, not much work around where he's from. So he goes abroad and he starts working on different building sites in England, number one, and then he goes to Australia and he starts working with other nationalities, and they're all yapping away in their own language, which is fine, and he finds that beautiful. So they think my dad is English.
Right.
Because he talks English. And dad is, it's a constant battle for him to prove himself that he's not English. And then that's where the identity really kicks in for him, you know. And they ask him, well, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Ireland. Oh, very good, Irish. And do you speak Irish? He says, yeah, we do have a language. He says, can you speak it? No, I can't. That's a driving force behind him to, if he did have a family, that they would speak Irish. He goes to Fiji on a holiday, meets mum, who has left her small, tiny island of Rotuma, which is 400 miles northwest of mainland Fiji. But the island is so small, I mean, there's nothing on the island, you know, work-wise. When you finish secondary school, most people just go to mainland Fiji for work.
What was it like landing here from Sydney in 88?
I'm devastated, demoralised, just questioning what am I doing here, because basically I should be on the sandy shore near Manly in Sydney, Australia.
I'm Brian Henderson, this is News Centre 9.
Lived in Sydney, Australia for 8 years at that stage. What a great upbringing, great place to grow up.
Dad would often talk about Ireland, you know, but to us that was an imaginary place far, far away, you know.
We lived in a two-bedroom house with a growing family, so you had to share a bed with a sibling. So he'd wake myself and Dio up 12:30 in Australia. And because of the time difference, the All-Ireland final was on 3:30 here. And he'd listen to the All-Ireland commentary on radio, and he'd get us to listen to it. Myself and Dio hadn't a notion, hadn't a clue what was going on or what we were listening to.
It's safe, and it's saved by Michael Cavini.
But it seemed to be important to Dad.
I suppose when we first came here, I suppose my first kind of heat of Ireland was like getting off that plane in Dublin, you know, where boom, you're hit with the weather.
I must be wearing 10 jumpers at that stage just to keep me warm. And I experienced rain that I've never experienced ever before, where it just rains constantly for days and days with no stop.
It was an awful, you know, awful experience. And I remember looking at Dad saying, geez, what are you after doing to us here? You know, and then traveling down here. I suppose settling in Cork was probably the best decision that he ever made.
The next challenge then is I know no one here. There's like I'm 10 years of age. So I'm frightened a small bit. You have to start your life again. And it's like you're on stage trying to prove your existence in the place and trying to win over new people and friends and all of that. I'm not painting a good picture of, you know, Cork and the north side of Cork City, but fast forward 37 years and I love the place. It's home. I can't see myself living anywhere else bar here.
What's the draw that brings him from Sydney to want to go to Cork?
It's a question I still haven't asked Dad. Do you know, why Cork? Why not Fermanagh? Why not Dublin? Which was the capital, you know, Cork is the real capital, but Dublin is, on paper, Dublin's the capital. That's a joke, okay? But my only explanation that I could come up with is I do remember growing up in Sydney, Dad's friends coming over for beers or, you know, barbecues or, you know, family gatherings. And a lot of them were Cork people. And he worked with a lot of Cork people. And I'd imagine that probably rubbed off on him. Cork seemed to be a fit for what he ideally wanted from a young family growing up in a place where there was Gaelic games, the Irish language, and everything cultural that Dad had imagined having left Ireland for 20, 25 years, 30 years at that stage, and just wanted the kids to be immersed and in that type of environment. So I'd imagine that's how we ended up in Cork.
I suppose Dad did want us to be immersed in Irish culture, and he knew that it would help us with the transition to coming here.
When Dad used to talk about Ireland, We never believed that such a place existed.
To us, that was an imaginary place far, far away, you know.
We'd imagine like that was all concocted in Dad's head, like in Ireland. Ireland to us might as well been, you know, up in the galaxy there somewhere, like, you know.
When it came to that adaptation, how important was the club here and the school? Because sport becomes a fairly central part of you pretty much the minute that you land, doesn't it?
I thank God for a lot of things, but I thank God for the GA because it was the icebreaker for myself and the family to help us settle into local community life here and new life in Cork. When we land here originally, like, this huge fanfare, you know, amongst the housing estate like that, we might as well been the Martians coming from Mars. This is Ireland in the late 80s now. Because of my mum's genes, we all look like mum. I look around the state, no one looks like me. It's pretty much a white collar society. So we stick out like a sore thumb. And that brings its own challenges too. And it can be intimidating coming to a place where you don't look like the rest of the people.
I would say it was quite difficult. Homogenous is a kind way of describing Irish society then, and perhaps even now. I would say it was very difficult for them. I'd say there was a huge amount of ignorance, and I think he's spoken himself. People didn't know if he was from Fiji or the Philippines. There was a mystery because, I suppose, Irish society was universally white. The kind of resistance to difference that we see even now, I would say, was more pronounced even then.
Were you ever made to feel like an outsider, or was that more something that maybe was in your own mind?
A bit of both. Initially, that was probably more in my own mind, the fact that I didn't know people and I looked different to the other kids, you know, in the neighbourhood. I'd say the people here, when I arrived, didn't know anything about, you know, mum's background, mum's culture. How could they, you know? Like, it's not every day Fijian walks down Fair Hill of Farnry, you know, kind of, it just doesn't happen. It hasn't happened since 1988 when we came. There's been no other Fijian come to the area, so how could they, you know? And then they're probably just trying to work us out as much as we're trying to work out own, you know, new surroundings here. But what the Pearshay Hurling and Football Club did for us was it probably introduced us or put us on a platform where people got to know us better. And the more they got to know us better, the more they realised, like, sure, they're like us. They're exactly like us. What glues us all together is hurling them when I start playing with the man.
Because of his heritage, obviously, people noticed Sean O'Clain, and there was a crackle of rumour or suggestion on the pitch that there was someone very different playing for the Pearshay.
With the sport, you know, for Sean Og and the boys and even us settling into schools, you know, and I suppose that's the thing about Gael Coláiste as well, or Gael Scanlan, you know, you were immersed into the Irish culture straight away, you know, and it's something that we all took to.
He became a hero for us, like, very soon. We were similar in age, but, like, at that stage of our career when we were just kids and he was making, say, Cork minor teams and stuff like that, that's kind of when we started to realise that he was exceptional and he was different for us.
I get a school education, which is second to none, but I get an education in hurling, which brings me up another level that I probably wouldn't necessarily get at a club level. And for the first time, I meet, to me at the time, cranky, tough taskmaster in the name of Donal O'Grady. Little did I know he would have a huge influence on my school career, but on my hurling career, because he coaches me later on at Cork senior level. He's a man not to be messed about. I just see him as my coach and Irish teacher in school. I treat Irish the same way that I would have treated hurling: practice, practice, practice. I learned fairly quickly that his training is meticulous, is very organised, and the magic in his training is repetitions. Like, you do hook and drill, like, you don't repeat it by tens, you just repeat it by hundreds. Like, if you'd ask me after my 5 years in the mound, what did I learn hurling-wise, I learned how to hook, block, flick. And I learned how to hook, block, flick. Hook, block, flick. Hook, block, flick. Hook, block, flick. That was the mantra. It was just doing the basics exceptionally well, but just repeat, 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 until it just became so ingrained in second nature. And then the proof was in the games then.
He's always been to me the ideal example of someone who takes up hurling pretty late, you know, commits to learning the skills and makes a huge success out of it.
My father was always involved in hurling. He would have played with our club, he would have coached in our club, so we were up there since 5 years of age. But that's generally when kids start, like, there's 5, 6, 7 years of age. But for somebody to be, like, parachuted in at a later age and not knowing anything about hurling and to achieve what he's achieved is it's certainly remarkable.
That just sums up, you know, Sean Oak in a nutshell. You know, if he puts his mind to something, or if he has 100% belief in something, he will just immerse himself into it, and there'll be no stopping him. He would have been up against a lot of kids that would have been born with hurleys in their hands.
Jeez, I'd like to think if I had grown up here as a 5 or 6 year old, do you know what I mean, and then picked up hurling at that stage and not 11 years of age or 12 years of age, you know, what could have been, do you know what I mean? But like, for me, you just have to make the best of, you know, the situation you fall into. So at that stage, you're seen as a late learner, like, you know, at 11 years of age, you look around, there's not many 11-year-old kids who pick up the game and then go on to represent the mind court, but like, they don't represent the club at senior level here. After a very successful Harty Cup campaign in 94, where we win it and we go on to win the Crow Cup, that puts me in the shop window to play Cork Minors.
I suppose you can't overstate the importance of colleges hurling in development of players at that time. In the mid-90s, it was extremely competitive. The North Mon was very competitive. I think Sean Oak's class or team remains the last one to win the Harty Cup, which is the kind of blue ribbon of colleges hurling. And that would be huge for all of those players in terms of their confidence and their development, because you're playing against schools and colleges in other counties, so you're beginning to realise, hang on a second, I'm as good as these guys from Tipperary and Limerick and Clare and Waterford. It's a big confidence booster. They're big games, there's a lot of focus on them.
The Kwan was there, you know, seeing him transition year on year and improve on year on year, you know. When he started playing with the minors, you know, definitely by the time, you know, 98, 99, and when he got the call in 1999, I kind of knew then that, look, yeah, he's after making it.
I'm underage for the following year at minor, and we win the minor All-Ireland, and I'm coached by no other than Jimmy Barry Murphy. Outside of Christy Ring and Jack Lynch, Jimmy's probably the next greatest Cork Gael there is.
Like, just seemed to have something different, like secret sauce, and all the players kind of respected him, looked up to him. Every time he's come back and done the job, he's been successful, so... I think he really got that group in 99 and glued them together, made them champions.
There's two names that I remember from the radio commentary in my young years in Australia. One is Jimmy Barry Murphy, because it's a long name, isn't it? Like, how can you forget a very long name? So so that name sticks out, and the other name is Jack O'Shea. So fast forward on, Jimmy is the minor manager in 94 and he's the minor manager in 95. I played those 2 years under Jimmy, and there I am playing for a Cork icon.
It's kind of difficult to talk about Jimmy Barry Murphy in objective terms, because he trails such a reputation really in Cork. It's very difficult to put anyone on his level. You know, he's a kind of a Roy Keane, Sonny O'Sullivan, unifying figure in the whole city and county. And I suppose, as an impressionable 17, 18-year-old, to have him come in and say, I want you to do this, you need to do that, is something that would certainly impress itself deeply on a player at that time.
I think Jimmy's greatest asset is he just sees himself as a normal person living a normal life, but he's such a positive influence on people. And then after being in Jimmy's company, you'd walk away feeling that you're 10 foot tall. You know, he gives that air of confidence in you. The fact that he's done it all in the red jersey before, I mean, you just want to run through a brick wall, you know, to win for him. That's the great thing about Cork, that you have heroes that have gone before you, that you want to emulate, you know, what they've done, and it's just the passing on of a torch to the next generation, to the next generation, to the next generation. So when you add all these things up together, you fairly wise up that you're in greatness here, you know, that you mightn't ever be with again, you know.
Inner Drive is brought to you in partnership with Allianz, proud sponsors of Irish sport for over 30 years. With one in five kids dropping out of sport during the transition to secondary school, Allianz's Stop the Drop campaign aims to keep them engaged. For resources and to learn more about Stop the Drop, head to allianz.ie/stopthedrop.
This is the call of the Crave. The sound that tells you it's time to go to White Castle, and it can happen anytime. Like your son's first bike ride.
Dad, look, I'm doing it.
I got you, buddy. Keep going.
Dad? Dad? Dad!
Follow your Crave to White Castle and get 10 cheese sliders for just $7.99 with your choice of American, cheddar, or jalapeno cheese. White Castle. Follow your Crave. Limited time only at participating castles. Tax not included.
When I was coming through the gate earlier on, it's Hurling and Football Club, which is written on the sign.
Yeah.
Was football always kind of second for you? Because, you know, around about the same time, you almost do a Teddy McCarthy on it, and you almost win two All-Irelands in the space of a few weeks. Was football always second for you to hurling, or did you have them on equal weighting for you?
So I grew up in an environment and a culture here where you're encouraged to play both sports, you know, and to a very high level. So on the back of that, I do play, when I mention I play Cork hurling in minor, I equally play Cork hurling in football. After that, when I play with the Cork under 21 hurlers, at the same time I'm playing under 21 football with Cork as well. Ultimately, what puts pay to my football career at inter-county level is I'm in a car accident. I badly damaged my knee. I miss a year and a half of playing, and one of the advices is that I need to concentrate and focus on one to not overload my knee.
Can I take you back to the car accident 24 years ago now at this stage? So you're up at a sponsor shoot in Dublin, I think is the way this works out, and you're trying to get back down to Cork. The roads maybe aren't quite what they are now, 20 odd years on.
There's no motorway, it's in late May. We're down to play Limerick that Sunday in the first round of the Munster Championship. Going through Tipperary, I'm involved in a very bad car crash. When you look back on the moment, you can remember blow by blow a second, you know, leading up to it. So before impact, I just remembered there was lights flashing, you know, and then next there's the collision, which happens like a nanosecond. It's like it's done before you even realise it. I looked down towards my leg, maybe because that's where I'm at my most painful. I look at this bulging thing coming out halfway up my thigh, and I don't know what it is at the time, but it's just sticking out of my chinos. And I give a roar, because obviously I'm in pain. My first sign that I know I'm in strife is I open up the door, and my first leg out that I got to plant is my right leg. When I go to put my foot on the ground, I buckle. Next, there's a man, he comes to me and he says, everything okay? He tells me he's a next door neighbour. And then all of a sudden, I'm crying, and then I'm in back of an ambulance going to Nina Hospital. Even though I'm in pain, it's the adrenaline that's really masking the real pain, you know, and it's not till a few hours later that I'm in Nina Hospital that they have to give me morphine and painkillers because the pain is just excruciating, like, you know. And then I'm transferred down to CUH where I'm operated, you know, that same day. And it finds out that lump that I see coming out of my leg is my kneecap. I'm 22 years of age at that stage, and in my naivety, I still think that I can get up, walk, and play the game on Sunday. And then the Cork medical doctor, Dr. Con Murphy, has to break the news to me like that's not going to happen. And he says, look, you're going to be in the sidelines for a while. So a while in my head is, oh, sure, grand, yeah, we'll win Sunday and I'll be ready for the Munster final. He says, no, you won't be ready. I says, okay, sure, look, we win the Munster final and we'll get to the All-Ireland semi-final, I'd be grand. He says, no, you won't be grand, boy. So I get where this is going. I says, what are we looking at? So the doc, and he says, you're lucky if you get back walking, you know, properly again after that. And I start bawling, crying. And I hug Con. I says, it can't end up like this. And he says, it won't. I know it won't, he says. But he says, you have a bit of work to do. And he says, look, if there's anyone to get back, he says, from that type, he says, it's you. And just those words, I clutch onto as hope and faith. I still joke to Dr. Con. I said, did you mean those words, Connor? And he says, I leave that up to you.
I think what's different to O'Shaughnessy is that it was an accident. It wasn't a sports injury. It wasn't, you know, your typical cruciate injury when you see someone go down, buckle under a tackle and say, oh, he's in trouble. I think a part of the issue was that people knew on a kind of a conceptual level that he was in a car crash and he hurt his knee. But obviously that was outside the realm of sports injury, so people weren't really familiar with what was happening. And actually the injury was a good deal more severe than people probably knew at the time. The fact there were no great guarantees that he would, you know, return to full fitness, that I think one or two medics actually advised him just to forget about it. And I think that's something really that not a lot of people have focused on when considering his career in its entirety.
So for a year I just rehabbed my knee, because I just can't let my career end up at 22 years of age. There's more hurling to be done. You miss your teammates at that stage, you know, because you had built up a nice routine, and then when that's taken away, then like kind of you feel the loss greatly.
I was really worried about him, you know, going from someone who was so sporty, so dedicated to hurling and football, you know, who was so used to being out and about, and now what we had is someone that is laid up, you know, and knowing that he mightn't get back there. But at the same time, I knew if he was given any glimmer of hope, if there was any man that could do it, it would be Sean Oak.
Was there any kind of fear that maybe the career is over at that point when he says that?
There are instances throughout your rehab where you just say, no, I don't think it's happening here, you know. Rehab is funny, and it's more mental. It's more mental challenge than physical challenge. Your knee is healing and it's improving physically, but it's the mental side of it, like kind of that you have to deal with Morse and the demons. And there are some weeks of rehab where it's just not happening. It's not probably progressing as fast as you'd like to at that age. The word patience doesn't come into your vocabulary. It just doesn't, you know. You just want it to be right tomorrow. And so you make great strides, and then you could go a week back, you make great strides, and you could go 2 weeks back.
The way he conducted himself, you knew he was going to come back.
There are times there, like, where I'm not physically crying, but I'm crying inside, like, I'm feeling sorry for myself, and, like, you're asking questions like, why me? Do you know, why does this have to happen to me? Why not someone else?
It's lonely because, you know, you'll always see sports people say, you know, I hurt my arm, I hurt my leg, then I wasn't part of the team's plans, so I wasn't part of the team, so it's thrown back on my own devices. And there's a whole cliche about mental toughness and resilience, etc. But I think that's what it translates into, that for these sports people, they're faced with a prospect of going to a gym on their own. There's no one there to help or to advise. So it's up to them to do the rehab, and it's boring and it's repetitive, and the mental toughness comes in doing that, because you've got that aim, that goal down the line to get back playing.
I go through that roller coaster experience, you know, over like 18 months of up and down, up and down.
Did you come back a better player?
No.
Took a while.
It took me another year to get back to any bit of level that I was pre-car crash. And it's even more frustrating, you know. So if I thought the 18 months of rehab was excruciating, when I got back playing a year after that, was the worst ever, because you're back, you're playing, which you wanted to do, but you're just not delivering, or you're not performing as well as you know that you can. And like, not for the want of trying to get to the ball, you're trying to get the ball as much, but it's just in, like, just not happening. You're trying to get to the breaking ball, you're there, but it's just not happening.
Looking at him coming back, I mean, you're hopeful, as you would be for any player coming back after a serious injury, that at least, you know, they'd regain their standard. The one thing was Cork were not going well. So if he wasn't going well, he didn't stand out because the team was really at a crossroads.
There's a bit of soul searching to be done, because you're saying, like, kind of, you're after gone through this phase where, you know, you've left no stone unturned and you've done everything right. And you're led to believe, like, once you go through that, that you'll be a brand new version of yourself. And it doesn't happen. And maybe that was a brand new version of me, but I hadn't accepted it yet. So after that year, I'm just deflated, you know. But you just talk to yourself to say, look, it just can't end up like this, you know. Like, you've gone so far now, there's no U-turn now, like, you know. Like, like, it's like you've gone to a remote island and you've burnt your boat, you know what I mean? Like, there's no, like, you're on the island, that's it. So I put in a very good pre-season, late 2002, early 2003, and it starts to click for me then, in 2003 then. My leg feels more freely. I see it in my performances in the league. That rolls into the championship. And then after that, then my knee injury becomes a distant past to me.
I've read you say before that you regret what happened around the strikes. I kind of wonder, is that something that brought the panel together? Or if you were to look back at it 20 odd years on now, what would the Sean Ogg of now say to the Sean Ogg decision making back then?
No doubt, like, the strikes did galvanise that panel. It did, like. I wish it hadn't happened.
It sounds silly now, because, like, the amount of add-on staff and the strength and conditioning coaches, the dietitians, and you have to remember back then there was none of that. It was just coming on to a new kind of era of professionalism, if you want, for want of a better word, but. Like, the teams were training, they were conditioning themselves better, and we just wanted to be ahead of the pack, and we felt at that stage that we weren't, and the group took action at that stage to try better ourselves, or give ourselves a better chance to be more competitive.
It'll go to each and every one of our graves, do you know what I mean? As well as the success that we had, you know, it'll be always inscribed afterwards, part of three strikes, like, you know, kind of, which is not a nice thing to have on your CV, but unfortunately, you know, it is, like, and it still pains me to this day, it hurts, you know.
The first strike came about because the players weren't happy with the standards of preparation, what they were being offered. They felt they needed higher standards in terms of gym access and food and transport and so on and so forth.
Small stuff like that the people take for granted right now, just to try get the team on a level playing field for what we saw other counties were getting in terms of, like, for us to prepare to perform on the big championship day.
It was a difficult period, to put it mildly. There was a march through the centre of the city at one stage. There were thousands marching in favour of the players. There was a kind of a constant tension when you were speaking to people, because even casually at a game, you know, was this person for the strikers? Was he for the county board? You know, it was a it was not something really you could be neutral.
We had something to prove after that, because we take on the county board, we look for a list of demands, which we think is reasonable, to give us a fighting chance of winning All-Ireland. They concede, or they at least, do you know what I mean, kind of...
Met you somewhere on the demands,
meet
yeah.
up demands. So next, the spotlight is on us. It's not on the board, it's on us. Okay, lads, okay, here we go. You have what you want. You're saying that you can't win All-Ireland because you don't have that. There you go. And I think that's where we bond, because we know, like, a shit of burst, like... We don't do it, you're the laughing stock for the rest of your lives. So that really connects us to a different level, and you get a different type of animal. And I don't think that team probably wouldn't have been as good as they were, only for like that they had something to prove.
For me, it was all about putting structures in place, so that no other inter-county team would have to worry about all that stuff in terms of preparation. That everything will be laid on for them, and all they'd have to do then is come down and give of their best and perform on the day. And I think that's the basic level, and I think that's where it was at the time.
That group of players, like me including that group of players, would be labelled if we hadn't, you know, backed it up. I'd say for some guys it was like leave the country, like, do you know, like, can I leave the country and don't come back?
Does the pain of all that, maybe the doubts of all that, does it make 04 and 05 sweeter, given that you had to have that period?
Oh, absolutely. My God. And maybe in hindsight, do you know, my 04 and 05 probably wouldn't have happened unless I hadn't gone through 02 and 03.
Like, Sean O'Good have played wing back all through his career. And like in every sport, okay, there's certain expectations and positions. And as a half back, the clue is in the name, you're a back, you're a defender, you're there to mark someone. But there's also an expectation that a half back will also be creative, will come upfield, will score the odd time, will link the play. So it's not just a matter of my job is to mark you and to block you out and make sure you don't score. Some of the greatest hurlers have been in the half back line, because the game is in front of them and they have the freedom to come upfield. Now, it's demanding because you have to be super fit. You have to have an eye to score. You have to be able to read the game, which is one of the biggest assets any hurler can have.
What becomes very clear to me at that stage is appreciation for every game you play, every year, like every game you play, any minute you play, every year you spend in the dressing room, because basically what you call it, tomorrow, this might be here tomorrow, like, you know. Once I know I'm on the edge of the cliff looking down, you find out your real self and your real character comes out, do you know what I mean? I don't think I would have maximised my playing career, you know, kind of, or maximised myself as a hurler, if it wasn't for the experience of the car crash.
The core of the team was there from the 99 win, and then we had a few young fellas that came on, we call us young fellas, that were just coming out of minor. In that team there was just an abundance of talent. I mean, we complemented each other's style, I think. Like, Sean Hogg was probably more the most physical or the most athletic out of the three of us, to say the least. And I mean, for us as a team, like, we got to the final in 2003, and that was the first time Cork were in the final since 99. And we were unsuccessful that day. And I think, like, secretly that drove us on to, that kind of bonded us more as a team to know that we could get to the final, and that we wanted to push ourselves to get over the line at that stage. We started keeping possession a bit longer. We were introduced maybe a running game that wasn't there previous to that. And it just suited us, and we liked playing that sort of game. And I think it took opposition teams a couple of years at that point to kind of adapt to what we were doing. So I think we changed the landscape of hurling a little bit.
When you're picking a captain of a team, generally speaking, I suppose you want someone who can lead by example. Now, Sean O's dedication to fitness and preparation would be second to none. That was taken as read, but certainly also led by example on the field that day, that year. in the All-Ireland semi-final against Clare, things were going against Cork. And I remember he got a point, and he wouldn't have been a big scorer, no, but as captain, he obviously felt the need, drove upfield, got a point, helped lead that comeback. So in that sense, it was a captain playing a captain's part, certainly. Against Galway in that final, you know, even though Cork were favourites and had a bit of experience, Galway were coming in on the back of a very good defeat of Kilkenny, scored a lot of goals, etc. So it certainly wasn't a gimme, as they say. But from start to finish, really, that year, I thought he led by example. I thought he kind of exemplified what a captain should be. And the players responded to that. And you could see that they were playing for each other and playing for him.
It was just a culmination of a group of talented people with the right management team in place, and we just got over the line twice.
If I look at the other scenario, if the car crash hadn't came, I was after winning the an All-Ireland in 1999. I could have coasted for a few years, you know, thinking that you were the finished article and then you were the best, and then I probably wouldn't have had to work as hard.
He was definitely ahead of his time in terms of conditioning his body and strength and conditioning and stuff. Opposition felt that if they could get the better of Sean Ogg, that the rest of us, like we looked up to him so much, or he was such a leader for us, that if they could get the better of him, that they'd have the upper hand. They'd probably put their best forward on Sean Ogg to try to get the better of him. Secretly, we were delighted. First of all, because we didn't have to mark the opposition best player. But second of all, because we knew like that the bigger the challenge for Sean Ogg, that he'd meet it head on, and that it was nearly a fill-up for us when we saw the likes of Henry Shefflin coming out and marking Sean Ogg on the big day. What differentiated Sean Ogg from everybody else was his athleticism at that time. Like, this guy has done it all, he's seen it all, he's come back from injury, he's won All-Ireland as a captain.
Not many people get to do that. Never mind someone who was born in a tiny little island called Rotuma, you know, hundreds of miles outside Fiji.
I suppose a big association a lot of people will have with Sean Ogg is Micheál Mór Hurtig's line. When he started breaking in first, and Micheál was commentating and said, "Here's Sean Ogg Halpine. His mother's from Fiji, his father's from Fermanagh, neither a hurling stronghold."
When I look at myself coming here, I was a very frustrated, disappointed, angry kid. So striking that slitter was a good way of releasing the tension that I was experiencing. And I didn't say those words to my parents or my brothers and sisters. But it was just internally, I just needed to vent something out. And then hurling was a great foil to do that. And it became a drug to me. You're striving for perfection. What started off as a casual hobby ended up dominating my life still to this day.
This is the call of the Crave. The sound that tells you it's time to go to White Castle, and it can happen anytime. Like your son's first bike ride.
Dad, look, I'm doing it.
I got you, buddy. Keep going.
Dad? Dad? Dad!
Follow your Crave to White Castle and get 10 cheese sliders for just $7.99 with your choice of American, cheddar, or jalapeno cheese. White Castle. Follow your Crave. Limited time only at participating castles. Tax not included.